On April 28th, June was taken into the hospital. Whereas Cash was not initially aware of the seriousness of her condition, she appears to have instinctively realized that something major was wrong. "I think that she knew," says John Carter. "Before she left for the hospital, she had me come in with her to the room and go through stuff. She wanted to talk to me about things, about what should happen if she died. I think she knew she was going." When she underwent the test, June was apprehensive about her chances of survival. "I just don't have the energy," she told Michelle Rollins, who went with Cash to visit her. They discussed the options until it became clear to everyone that there were really only two options: certain death almost immediately, or the chance of an extended life. Cash was distraught about the possibility of losing June, telling her how much he loved her and how his life would be over if she were to leave him. They chose the possibility of life. When Merle Kilgore visited, Cash seemed remarkably composed. "He was sitting in his wheelchair at the hospital and he reached out both hands to greet me," says Kilgore. "I remarked to him that he seemed so strong. He said, 'No, I'm really weak inside.' He said, 'I can talk about June without breaking up because I'm dehydrated. I can't make any tears.'" The next 2 weeks proved the most harrowing of Cash's life. Hopes of a remarkable recovery were soon dashed by June's lapse into coma. The devastating moment when they agreed to unplug the life support machine was closely followed by the excruciating period of waiting for her body to finally close down. "Part of him was gone," says John Carter of the effect of her death. "The two were one. When she left, part of him just wasn't there anymore." "He was the most alone person I'd ever seen in my life," remembers Kelly. "It was so strange to walk into his house and not to see June and to know that we were never going to see her. I don't think he'd ever been alone. He'd always had very strong women around him. June was someone who had been stable for him, and I looked at him and realized that for the first time he was alone, and he was lost." Cash never went back to their marital bed. Instead, he slept on a twin bed in his office with the pillows propped up to avoid acid reflux. Surrounding him were the things he loved: his guitar, his Bible, more than 500 books of theology, history, poetry, music, fiction, and Western lore, a TV almost always tuned to CNN, and a framed photograph of June that he spoke to constantly. He napped there in the afternoon and slept there at night, waking around 5 a.m. for his first coffee of the day. "John struck me as a quiet, pensive man," daughter-in-law Laura Cash says. After June passed in May, he seemed to withdraw even more from having much conversation. "Many times John Carter and I would sit with him for long periods with no words spoken. I believe it was a comfort to him to have someone there who didn't feel it necessary to talk." After a time of grieving, he knew the only way to cope with his loss was to get back to his music. He said to me, "I've got to get into the studio, son." And so that's what we did, says John Carter. The first project he worked on was a collection of Carter family songs, and then he continued with what he wanted to be the follow-up to The Man Comes Around, an album already being referred to as American Five. John Carter continued in the role of associate producer. One of the musicians working on these sessions was his old friend Jack Clement, now into his sixth decade of working with Cash. "I was pretty proud of the way John Carter rose to the occasion," he says. Cash got to the point where he couldn't even read, much less decipher lyrics, but John Carter would sing them in the sessions so that he could learn to play them. Cash had been taping new songs ever since completion of the last album. At the same time, preparations were underway for a 5-CD box set that would contain the best of the American recordings already released, as well as the best of the work not used. David Ferguson flew back and forth between Nashville and Los Angeles to sift through hundreds of hours of tape with Rick Rubin for the box sets and work with Cash in his home studio. "He was weak by now," says Ferguson. "His voice would come and go. He never knew from one day to the next whether he was going to be able to sing. He was real weak. He was in a wheelchair and sick, but whenever he could and whenever he felt like it, he wanted to record because he really wanted to finish up that record." On June 21st, he played 7 songs at the Carter Family Fold in Virginia to celebrate what would have been June's 74th birthday. The concert, organized by Jeanette Carter, June's 80-year-old cousin, attracted almost 1,600 people, twice the venue's normal capacity. With his wispy gray hair and sunken features, he was a husk of the man he had once been and seemed wrapped in a cloak of loneliness. "I don't know hardly what to say tonight about being up here without her," he said. The pain is so severe there's no way of describing it. He'd bury himself in his music, says Ferguson. He was lonely. He had fun when he was recording because he was surrounded by his friends. I've been working with him a long time, and I know that's one reason that he liked to work, to have buddies around him. He had people like Pat McLaughlin, Jack Clement, Mark Howard, Randy Scruggs, Marty Stewart. His daughter Cindy came to stay with him in June. Although he was 80% blind, he had her bring more photographs of June to his office. He even had Mark Burkhart, an artist from Austin, Texas, paint June's face on the elevator doors. He missed her so bad, says Cindy. He sobbed for her daily. He would pick up the phone to talk to her as if she was on the other end. Cindy would take him to sit outside in the sun, but after 30 minutes he was ready to come back in and lie down. Almost all of his enjoyments had now been taken away from him. One time she took him in his wheelchair to see June's grave. He stared at it a while and tried to focus so that he could see the tombstone, she says. As soon as he had focused, he said, "I'm coming, baby. I'm coming." That upset me. I had to tell him that I didn't want to hear those kinds of things. Her sister, Tara, came to visit for 3 days in July, and she spent hours sitting with him in his office or outside the house. Knowing that it was almost certainly going to be their last time together, she made tapes of their conversations and of a game he enjoyed playing where she would throw a random topic at him and he had to dig up an appropriate song from his encyclopedic mind. I'd say, "Dad, sing a song about a rock," and he'd break into one, she says. Then I'd say, "Sing one about grass," and he'd break into one. I did that for maybe 30 subjects. He loved it. I think it helped to keep his mind active, and he loved the challenge. As Cash's eyes and legs grew weaker, his faith appeared to grow stronger. He had a light box that projected pages of his Bible onto a screen so that he could read it with his 20% vision. He talked regularly on the phone with Billy Graham, someone whom he'd always relied on as a rock to lean on in times of trouble. "I think that God had given him such faith, almost to the point of it being unreal," says Kelly. "I think that's the only way he made it. I think he had the utmost faith in God, and he looked to God for his strength and direction." After the funeral, he could have gone to bed and told everyone that he wasn't going to get up again. He could have gone into isolation, but he chose not to. He could have got angry, but I never saw him angry. What I saw from him was that he was lost, and he was still trying to find his way without her. But I didn't see the same man that I saw that day in the hospital, who was utterly broken. I didn't see that again. Cash had always said that he didn't fear death, but he now seemed to yearn for it, not in a morbid way, or even because it promised a relief from the pain. He believed that for a Christian, death was the gateway to eternal life. His sister Joanne remembers the times they spent together in his office, especially after June's death, when they would sit and discuss the Bible. He would look at me a couple of times with tears in his eyes, and he would say, "I can hardly wait to see heaven, to see the Lord, and to see our family. I know him, and I know how real it was to him."